This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Coming up right now is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show,
we're here in Australia,
and we're going to launch some rockets.
We're following two teams of scientists here to study a special pair of stars we can't see from most parts of the U.S.
They're part of the Alpha Centauri system, the closest stars to us besides the Sun. And with the help of NASA sounding rockets, they'll capture light from those stars that doesn't reach the ground and propel humanity's search for habitable worlds into the future.
Yes!
Follow along as I go into the outback to show you what it takes to launch a rocket and make groundbreaking scientific measurements.
There's a rocket in there.
3, 2, 1.
Hang on tight. We're going on an adventure, high above, down under.
And we have episodes 3 and 4 and some related poetry in that series. Well, let's head off into it. The Arnhem Space Centre is a new facility on the Gove Peninsula. On last week's The Space Show, Miles Hadfield explained why NASA sent a team of scientists and their technicians to Australia last year. Miles is a science writer for the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, just outside of Washington. This report is subtitled, More Than Just Sunburn.
UV light. You might know it as the stuff that causes sunburns, but in fact, it plays a key role in making life possible.
UV light is the range of light just beyond human vision. Even though we can't see it, UV light from the sun has fundamentally shaped the planet we live on. Could it be a key to finding other planets capable of supporting life? I know some rocket scientists who think so.
We're here in Australia!
And we're gonna launch some rockets.
We're following two NASA rocket missions as they try to understand how stars make the planets around them suitable for life.
I'm Miles Hadfield, and in this episode, we're exploring how ultraviolet light can make or break a planet's ability to support life.
When we look for planets around other stars and try to assess, is that a place where life exists? We're almost always talking about, does that atmosphere have the signs of life in it? And so that means things on Earth like, do we have molecular oxygen? Does it have ozone? Does it have methane in the atmosphere?
These special gases are what scientists call biomarkers, the traces of life we leave behind on our planet. But, Kevin told me, what counts as a biomarker on Earth might not for a planet orbiting a different kind of star. A lot of it depends on how much UV light the star emits, or what scientists call its UV flux.
There are kind of two big things that UV light does to a planet's atmosphere. One, it drives photochemistry in the atmosphere. So Earth's atmosphere is a combination of things that happen photochemically and things that happen biologically and then float up.
Our ozone layer is a great example. About 2.5 billion years ago, bacteria in Earth's ancient oceans had just become the first photosynthesizers. In other words, as those little guys broke wind, Earth's atmosphere started filling up with oxygen. Don't think too hard about that. UV light split those oxygen molecules apart, allowing some of them to recombine into ozone.
The other one is that ultraviolet light drives what we call atmospheric escape. And that's kind of as simple as it sounds. If the star has enough ultraviolet flux, it heats up the atmosphere, and if the atmosphere gets hot enough, that atmosphere will become gravitationally unbound to the planet and escape.
Believe it or not, this happened on Earth too. About 4.5 billion years ago, when Earth was just a wee baby planet, its original atmosphere was mostly made of hydrogen and helium. That atmosphere was blown off into space, paving the way for the livable, breathable atmosphere we know today.
One of the things we've learned in the last couple of years is the sun is atypical in that it's about 5 times less magnetically active than typical stars of its age. And magnetic activity is what drives the ultraviolet flux. So just because we have great data on the sun, it doesn't mean that we can take that data and apply it broadly to any type of star like the sun out beyond.
That's why Kevin and his team are looking at Alpha Centauri, our closest stellar neighbors. This 3-star system is a little more than 4 light-years away. Kevin and his team are focusing on the larger, sun-like stars, Alpha Centauri A and B. They're our best chance to measure UV light from sun-like stars that aren't, well, our sun. But Sistine can't do it alone. Another rocket mission is set to launch right after Sistine and would capture wavelengths of UV light too hot for Sistine to handle, so to speak. And members of Team Number 2, fittingly named Deuce, had just arrived. I'd heard they could be found somewhere around here, probably hiding away, hoping to get some work done before we started shoving cameras in their faces. Nice try. Hey, Emily.
Hey.
Your team, Deuce, and Sistine are both measuring ultraviolet light. So what's the difference between the things you're measuring? What are you setting differently?
So Deuce measures the extreme ultraviolet, which is a very energetic form of light. And Sistine is measuring far ultraviolet light, so a little bit less energetic, longer wavelengths. And we have a little overlap in our spectrum so that we can actually have a much broader spectrum than either of us would get alone.
I see. Yeah. Okay, so like overlap to just check that, like, okay, I'm seeing the same thing in that region of overlap as you are, and then we can calibrate together.
Exactly.
I see. Launching a few days apart, Deuce and Sistine will work together like one super mission. The end goal goes beyond Alpha Centauri, and even sun-like stars, to an understanding of star-planet systems in general.
Alpha Centauri is the closest star system to Earth, other than the Sun, and has in its triple stars one that's a sun-like star. So we can use that star to see what other stars that might have planets around it look like.
What is your role during launch? What are you going to be doing?
So I will be steering the payload.
You are pointing the telescope,
yes,
and making sure it's,
yes,
aligned on the star.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's a big job.
Yeah.
Next time, as we prepare for launch, a look behind the scenes at the space vehicles that will get us there. Vroom, vroom.
And we'll have episode 2 after this poem. Now, that triple star system, Alpha Centauri, includes that faint star, Proxima Centauri. And recently it's been shown that Proxima has an exoplanet, a planet circling it. And so this poem is called, Is Our Closest Neighbor an Eyeball Planet? A Proxima Poem. And it's by Sean Raymond and Marissa Raymond.
Is Our Closest Neighbor an Eyeball Planet? A Proxima Poem. By Sean Raymond and Marissa Raymond. Listen up, ladies and gents, near and far a planet's been found. Round the sun's closest star. Proxima Centauri, 4 light-years from us, has got a new planet I want to discuss. This planet and star. Now, you really should know 'em, and that's why I'm bothering writing this poem. There's 3 things that make this new planet so cool and make us astronomers everywhere drool. The first is its size. It's almost like Earth. Just a smidge bigger. It's near the same girth. This means that, like ours, it's a quite rocky planet. It's not made of gas. Maybe iron or granite. The second cool thing. Its orbit's just right. It isn't too cold. You won't freeze at night. It isn't too hot. You won't get sun-baked. You may even be able to swim in a lake. The third thing to know is the planet's so near that soon we'll be able to see it quite clear. They're building a telescope that's big and sees far. It'll take photos of Proxima B round its star. Remember, the planet is Proxima B. Proxima Centauri is the star that you see. The question on the top of everyone's mind, is there life on this world? Could it bear humankind? Could this planet be teeming with insects like ants? Or mammals like tigers? How about leafy plants? To answer this question, let's turn back the clock to when the planet was just a wee baby rock. When Proxima the star was born, it was brighter. The planet was hotter. Its atmosphere lighter. Some of its water escaped off to space. But was it enough to dry out this fair place? If so, I'll be wearing a sad frowny face. It took quite a while for the star to chill out. And during that time, Proxima b lost about enough water to fill oceans, and even lagoons. But what does that mean? Well, if we assume that the planet was born just as wet as the Earth, it would have held on to some water from birth. On Proxima b, you ask, what is the weather? Should I wear cotton or spandex or leather? I'm glad that you asked. I have a suggestion. Some nice climate models might answer your question. If the planet spins quickly, then its hottest region is at the equator each and every season. This is where we would find big oceans and lakes. We could sit by the seaside enjoying milkshakes. Now, if Proxima b has just one big deep ocean with no land in sight, only water in motion, the poles would be covered with ice that won't melt and warm water flowing along the world's belt. Watch this animation from a simulation of the just aforementioned C2iation. But, if Proxima b has a very slow spin then, like our moon, the same side will point in. The hottest place will be where the star's overhead. The sun doesn't move, it just sits there instead. And the opposite side sees the sun not at all. It's always in darkness, with sky, but that's all. This planet gets astronomers very excited. IDOCs of the world should be very delighted. If this is the case, it's an eyeball in space. A water world with only H2O on one face. Take a look here and see. One side's covered with oceans that go slish, slosh and slush and are always in motion. On the day side you can walk and wade in the tide. But, everything's frozen back on the night side. Of course, there's lots more that we want to know. We want to take pictures and see what they show. We want to know whether there really is water. A thick atmosphere? A day side that's hotter? Answers won't come for 10 years or more. But, please don't despair. We can learn much before. New discoveries in space are made all of the time. I'll keep blogging for you, though, not always in rhyme. Before I end, let's give three cheers to Proxima b, the planet that might be an eyeball, you see. This planet might even have snowfields and seas. And, maybe, just maybe, some dolphins and trees. While the planet's too far for humankind's plan B, it's the number one target to search for ET.
And that poem was written by Sean Raymond and Marissa Raymond. Now, back to the Arnhem Space Centre, where Miles Hadfield is about to tell us about the final test.
In the previous episode, we learned that to find planets that can support life, we have to understand the stars that host them. Especially the ultraviolet light those stars emit. But to see that ultraviolet light, we have to get above our own atmosphere. And the fastest way to do that is to launch a rocket.
Well,
We're here in Australia!
And we're going to launch some rockets.
We're following two NASA rocket missions as they try to understand how stars make the planets around them suitable for life. I'm Miles Hatfield, and in this episode, we're going to see what it takes to get a sounding rocket into space. If you ask me, sounding rockets are NASA's true MVPs. Their name comes from the nautical term to sound, meaning to measure. No astronauts here. These rockets specialize in carrying scientific instruments. They take short flights, spending just a few minutes in space before falling back to the ground for recovery. Scientists can then relaunch the same instruments again, and again, and again, adapting them to new purposes. It makes sounding rocket missions far less expensive than other alternatives, and a lot faster to develop, too. Many scientific firsts are achieved with sounding rockets because of their quick turnaround time. In fact, the two missions we're following, Sistine and Deuce, are breaking their own scientific ground. The ultraviolet light they measure could reveal whether sun-like stars throughout our galaxy are capable of supporting habitable planets. To get their instruments to space, they're relying on the experts from NASA's Wallops Flight Facility, who operate over 20 sounding rocket launches each year from locations all around the world. Still, no matter how many launches you have under your belt, there's one wild card that can undo even the best laid plans.
Roughly an hour and 15 minutes before launch, we start doing blooms every 15 minutes, and that's giving us those low-level winds. The closer we are to the surface, the more sensitive the rocket is to the impact of the winds.
For NASA's range and launcher teams, getting into space is only half the battle. These low-level winds will also affect where the rocket lands.
It's a suborbital rocket, so we go up and we come down. I'm required to keep the rocket within the hazard area because that's what we alert the public to stay out of, and we clear it, and that's kind of the box that we have to play in. You know, we're trying to aim a point that's downrange this way. Mm-hmm. We may have to point over here so that when the winds go up, it'll come up and impact there.
Using computer simulations, the launch team has figured out exactly how much wind the rocket can take without risking being blown off course. As launch approaches, Brittany keeps a close eye on the real-time wind measurements to be sure they stay within an acceptable range.
But it gets really exciting. In the final 2 minutes, you will see me and Mike with our eyes glued to that monitor and my finger on the button for my comms. You know, we're the ultimate safety authority. Yeah. It's our judgment call if the winds are trending out or if that was just a random data point and we can proceed.
Once the rocket is in the air, a whole slew of internal systems need to kick into high gear. I caught up with the Sistine science team as they were running the final sequence tests, simulating everything that will happen during the flight.
We simulate starting about 10 minutes before the launch itself, and we run through all of the steps you would, exactly as you would.
And the countdown clock has started.
90 seconds here, where we're about to hit T-minus 90, is my favorite part on launch night, which is where they're polling for the final go.
Go. Yeah. Go.
Where they're running through all the major subsystems and making sure that everything looks correct now, because this is the last chance to say that there's a problem before you're just assuming we're rolling into launch.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
First stage would have ignited first, and it's already burned out by 6 seconds. And then our black branch starts, which is the second stage. As you're launching, you want to be spun up, but then you want to stop that spin once you're observing.
What would happen if you guys didn't stop spinning?
Would probably be catastrophic.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Can we prepare for the shutter door to open?
Whoa. There it is.
So shutter door opens. Towards the center there, this black camera is our star tracker, and so that right now is figuring out where it is in the sky and then driving us over towards our target. Up there you can see our big primary mirror, and then this kind of X structure you see up front is holding our secondary mirror, so the second optic in our telescope. And now we're hopefully celebrating or talking about whatever went wrong during the flight at the same time.
Yes.
Once the payload has been fully tested and confirmed ready for flight, they bring it down from the payload assembly building to the launch rail, where it will be connected to the motors. This is the last place this experiment will sit on land before it launches into space. As night falls over the Arnhem Space Center, it's time to hope for good weather. If all goes well, we'll soon be high above it. Next time, the thing you've all been waiting for. It's going to get pretty loud.
And we invite you to listen to the space show next week when we'll find out what happened with that.